Peter Cummell Strowski, Your Honor, on behalf of Max Ireland and the estate of Thelma Ireland, attorney number 019621. The general issue in this case is whether an insurance policy purchased with a single premium under the 2007 Medicaid regulations in Colorado constituted a transfer of assets for less than fair market value, thereby triggering a Medicaid penalty period, in which the transfer would not be eligible for Medicaid. I'd like to start by saying that the Ireland family, Max, Thelma, and their kids, really behaved in a responsible way in planning for Max and Thelma's old age. They went to a private firm specializing in elder law, and they were told that one of the things that it could do without affecting their potential eligibility for Medicaid, which they hoped was far off, was buy life insurance. And this is, in fact, was good advice. In general, you can buy life insurance. It's one of the few means that the Medicaid regulations allow people to do, to take advantage of, to pass on some of their assets without disqualifying themselves from long-term care, Medicaid coverage of long-term care. I say generally true. The county and the state have taken the position that a policy purchase with a single premium does trigger a penalty period. And of course, had they known that, Ireland could have paid with multiple premiums, two premiums, or over a period of years. And so the specific issue here, the first one, is whether there's any reasonable way they could have known, whether the Irelands or their attorneys could have inferred this requirement from regulations. And I think it's pretty clear that they could not. For three reasons. First of all, there's nothing in the regulations specific to this. Life insurance is a fairly common transaction, purchase of life insurance, and you'd expect there to be something in there addressing this if that were intended, and it wasn't. A second reason is there's nothing about buying life insurance with two premiums or more premiums as opposed to a single premium that you would naturally think would be any sort of problem.
Well, is that right? I mean, isn't there a fundamental difference if you are making this one-time big payment up front and essentially getting rid of all that money at one time as opposed to making premium payments over time? I mean, is that clearly there's a factual distinction there. I guess the question is that an appropriate legal distinction?
Well, I think there's a question of whether they could have inferred what you're suggesting from the regulations. And I think that the change in the regulations that were made in 2012, whether you view that as a clarification or an actual change in the regulations, as I would argue, make it pretty clear that purchases made with more than one premium, two, three, or over a period of a year or whatever, do not violate the rule, would not trigger a penalty period. So how could the Ireland attorneys have pulled out of 2007 regs the idea that a purchase made with a single premium as opposed to, say, two would be a problem?
As long as you're on the subject, let me ask what your position is, because it wasn't totally clear to me in the briefs, on what effect, if any, the amendment to the regulations, which I guess was 2010, or maybe it's 2012, I can't remember, but it's much more recent. Are we entitled to take that into account in any way, and if so, how?
Yeah, I would argue that that is a change in the law. That I think that it's a change in the law that's significant not only for the proposition that it makes it clear that it was not the law before the change, it's also significant for what's not in there. A lot of the arguments made by the state in this case have to do with the number of power to change beneficiaries, the nature of ownership. The change in the regulation makes it clear that the only real problem that they had with the Ireland policy is that it was purchased for the same premium. There's nothing to change about any of the other arguments that the state raises.
Does the change also talk about the policy having no cash value, cash surrender value? Isn't that also part of any regulation?
That's except for very small life insurance,
Life insurance, I'm saying that's part of the new regulation. It's not simply the single premium that renders it an asset transfer.
Well, the fact that it has no cash surrender value, that's a requirement of any life insurance that's going to be excluded as an asset under the Medicaid regulations. If I were to buy any kind of policy, I think I could buy up to $1,500 for the face value of any policy of a significant amount. It has to be irrevocable. The money has to be gone, or it's not excluded as an asset. So that's sort of a given with any insurance that you buy. If they have purchased something, you know, this or anything remotely this size, that they had any power to get the money back from, borrow against, anything like that, it would not have been excluded, and the Ireland's would never have been eligible for Medicaid.
Right, it would be considered a resource to them.
That's correct.
But in this case, this policy did not have any cash surrender value, correct?
Right. Which was a special thing for them to do.
Correct, so doesn't that suggest it wouldn't be a resource in any event to the Ireland's?
No, it could not be, or it would disqualify them from Medicaid.
Right, but the fact that there's no cash surrender value also renders it not a resource, regardless of whether it's an excludable resource.
That's true. That's true.
So what does that tell you? I guess I'm not sure how that helps you, though, because in this case, the department's not saying that the insurance policy here was a resource. It's simply saying it was not a resource to the IRA. And isn't that entirely consistent with saying the IRA didn't really own it?
Okay, well, you're getting to the ownership question. Let me go ahead and address that. Life insurance is traditionally seen as owned by the people.
Yeah, I know you've said that a few times in your brief, but yep. Did you cite any authority for this traditional view of life insurance?
I do not. It's implicit in the Medicaid regs the way they're written. You wouldn't need to have an exclusion of irrevocable life insurance policies if the person who purchased it didn't own it.
Well, that assumes all life insurance policies are the same. But if some life insurance policies are owned by the purchaser and some are not, then the regulation is perfectly sensible.
Okay. In the administrative proceedings, I think the administrative law judge, just to address that, asked the state trust officer and the county representative who were at the hearing whether life insurance, other life insurance policies, whether they're, you know, let me take that back. The ownership thing didn't come up at that point. I'm thinking about something else. I guess I would say there's nothing in the regulations that would suggest, either the old regulations or the new ones, that would suggest that a policy could be owned by anybody except the purchaser. And that's in the new regs too, if that were really concerned. You think that would have been put in the clarification if that's what it was. I also think that if there is going to be a change from the traditional, and I don't have a cite for that, notion of life insurance ownership, that it's not something you could have ever read out of the regs. The principle, the state's theory of ownership looks to indicia of ownership, a model that was adopted by the probate courts. The only real indicia of ownership that's relevant here would be the power to designate beneficiaries.
Aren't there also other possibly relevant, such as the power to surrender the policy for cash or to revoke the policy?
Right. And my point on that is that those powers really don't apply here, because any policy that has the power to borrow against or surrender the policy for a cash value, unless it's a very small policy, render the person not eligible for Medicaid anyhow. So it's really the power to change beneficiaries that would be the addition, would be relevant in this context. And I don't think anybody could really have anticipated that when the Ireland's had the power to change their beneficiaries or not, would have had any effect on whether a transfer memory was triggered.
But doesn't that conclusion rest on the notion that rest on your notion of the traditional view of life insurance for which you've given us some authority?
I guess it does. It's just implicit in the nature of life insurance, and it's considered owned by the people who buy it. I don't. It's so implicit that I don't think I've ever seen.
Isn't there lots of authorities suggesting, as you put it in the probate context, that the ownership of life insurance is much more complex than you're suggesting, and maybe that's the more traditional view of life insurance?
It's more complex. Well, the probate cases have developed this theory of life insurance ownership for purposes of estate tax. And like I said, I think the only one part of that theory that really applies here is the power to change beneficiaries. And certainly, it's sort of like purchasing an insurance policy with more than one payment. Had Ireland known that it was important that they have the power to change beneficiaries, or that they purchase it with more than one payment, they and their attorneys certainly could have done that. It's hard to see why they would have thought that was significant.
The only theory we can find defines life insurance ownership by reference to the indicia of, or the incidence of ownership, and there's no authority in support of your view. Why would a reasonable person take your view?
Because it's implicit in the nature of life insurance, is that the regulations having to do with, go in circles here, the regulations having to do with exclusion of life insurance assume that it's owned by the purchaser. It's just implicit in there.
Well, now, why do you say that? When you say that's implicit, you're referring to the fact that if the life insurance policy has a cash surrender value and it's over $1,500, that's a resource.
That's correct.
But isn't that simply, that just tells us that when the insurance policy has a cash surrender value, the department will consider the applicant purchaser to be the owner. But how does that help us determine whether the department will view the applicant purchaser to be the owner when there's no cash surrender value? Isn't that just a different policy, which raises different questions?
I don't think there's any answer to your question other than the one I've given you, and I've looked. But I would say that if this theory of life insurance ownership were to be applied to Medicaid, it would require a review of probably, a very large number of Medicaid long-term care recipients' eligibility.
Is there anything in the record supporting your assertion there?
No. Let me just say one more thing, and then let me save my last minute for about all if I can. I also think that the life insurance purchase is not like any of the things that are listed as creating a penalty period in the regulations as they existed. All the things listed are situations where somebody buys something and gives the power over money to somebody who you might suspect would be a friend, or somebody who could use that money to turn around and help the person who gave it to them. Limited family partnership, a trust, an annuity while the donor is still alive. There are all situations where you have reason to suspect that somebody might be trying to help the family. That's really not like life insurance, where the money is just gone. There's no way the IRS can use, or anybody else can use that for their benefit until Max's death in this case. And then my last point I was going to make had to do with equities in this. The Ireland's entered into this transaction back in 2007. They filed appeals when the county told them this was not acceptable. And they waited 3 years. The federal regulation says that these kinds of disputes are supposed to be resolved in 90 days. They waited 3 years before they got their first county conference. Thelma had deceased by that time, and the family was slapped in limbo during that entire period with really no idea, no certainty as to how much they needed to have to take care of Max and Homer. And I would hope that some of those equities would be taken into consideration as well. And I'll reserve a little time I have left.
Thank you. So I've got a little less than 40 seconds for whatever rebuttal you want.
Okay, thanks.
May it please the court. My name is Carole Spedigue, attorney registration number 39208, and I represent the department in this matter. The question before this court today is whether the district court erred in affirming the department's final agency decision. a decision which held that Mr. Ireland's purchase of a single premium life insurance policy constituted a transfer without fair consideration. The appellants argued that the life insurance policy in question should not subject Mr. Ireland to any Medicaid penalties because no transfer of ownership took place. He represents that the policy should simply be considered an exempt resource and not a transfer at all. However, it's important to begin by emphasizing that to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to both be within the resource limit and also not have transferred assets without fair consideration. You need both of these things. Those barriers to Medicaid eligibility are designed to work together in tandem to avoid individuals who have the means to provide for their own care and maintenance from impoverishing themselves intentionally in order to qualify for state benefits, which is precisely the scenario you have before you today. In support of this position, I'd like to focus my discussion today on three things. First, the plain language of the statute in 2006, as it was written, the terms of the policy here and why it qualifies, and third, the underlying policy considerations and the concerns that those raise. First, turning to the regulation. In April 2007, at the time Mr. Ireland purchased the OM life insurance policy in question, the general provision of the transfer without fair consideration regulation stated, if an institutionalized individual or the spouse of such individual disposes of assets without fair consideration on or after the look-back period, that individual shall be subject to a period of ineligibility. The term assets was defined to include all income or resources, which the individual is entitled to but does not receive because of their own actions. But I'd like to emphasize that disposes of assets without fair consideration. The language represents the general overarching intent of this regulation that if you dispose of assets, you will be subject to a penalty period for doing so. You cannot simply transfer your wealth away in order to qualify for Medicaid. As is relevant here, the rebuttable presumption language in 2006 stated, actions that prevent income or resources from being received, as set forth on the following list, which is not exclusive, shall create a rebuttable presumption that the transfer was without fair consideration. The plain language indicates that the prohibited conduct here is action that prevents income or resources from being received, not the list. The non-exclusive list of examples is merely illustrative. They're there to provide guidance.
Counsel, can I interrupt you? What was the purpose and effect of the 2012 change to this part of the regulation?
It was absolutely, I would say it was absolutely in response to this litigation. The department felt it was clearly an implication by the language of the regulation that something like this would be prohibited. However, to make sure it was absolutely clear that transferring a lump sum of $161,000 a month before you applied for Medicaid into an irrevocable, non-transferable, you know, a life insurance policy you have absolutely no control over, or, you know, you're changing a resource you had access to into a financial instrument that you no longer have any control over and never will again, is a transfer without fair consideration. So that going forward, should this become a scam thing where we start to see a lot of these kinds of policies, there's no question. Because this is not typical life insurance. This is not a typical life insurance policy. Life insurance typically is, you know, nominal premiums for term life that you pay on a monthly basis, and then, you know, you reap those benefits after you pass. You don't generally transfer a large sum as was done here.
So that you go ahead.
I was just going to ask you to expand a little bit when you said this is the reason for the new regulation. Is that based on legislative history that is documented, or is that just your view of what happened here?
No, Your Honor, I think it was more, I think it's more my view. It seems pretty apparent that it was in response to this litigation that the department was simply codifying the intent that it had always had, which is the policy reasoning behind this regulation to prevent this exact type of thing where somebody transfers money that they have available to themselves for their own care and maintenance into some sort of financial instrument such as this type of policy that would eliminate that, in other words.
Counsel, following up on that, the 2012 change with respect to the single premium life insurance purchase, is that something that the department crafted on its own? Did it borrow it from another state? Did it borrow it based on guidance from the federal government? Is it entirely a Colorado creation?
I'm sorry, Judge, I can't speak to that. I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, but you don't know of any similar provisions in other state Medicaid regulations?
I have not researched that issue, and so I do not know.
Do you have any authority or a case interpreting any state's Medicaid regulations has held that this kind of purchase could be a transfer for fair, without fair consideration?
In another state?
In the state or other state?
No, I do not know of any. No, I do not know of any.
Thank you.
And as a corollary to what was asked of your learned colleague previously, do you have any authority that indicates what the typical type of an insurance policy is?
No, Judge, I would say that there's no typical life insurance definition because there are so many different types of policies. I would just say that term life as the general concept is a monthly, you know, where you pay a monthly premium, which is a more nominal amount than $161,000. But I have no authority for supporting one way or the other. What appellant is urging this court to do here is to impute a hyper-technical definition to the term transfer, requiring a change in legal ownership before any financial instrument can be considered a transfer without fair consideration. However, the language in the regulation doesn't speak to whether legal ownership has to be relinquished. It merely states that you have to dispose of assets or prevent yourself from receiving income. The regulation has to be read in the context of the rule as a whole and in the context of the entire regulatory scheme. So when given consistent, harmonious, and sensible effect to all of its parts, the regulation here, the language, indicates that Mr. Ireland disposed of assets without fair consideration by acting in a way that prevented him from receiving his own income and resources. He had $161,000 available to him a month before he applied for Medicaid benefits, and instead he chose to purchase a single premium life insurance policy that would benefit only his children, and only his children, assuming they survive the term of the policy.
Counsel, at the time of this transaction, 2007, was it the department's policy that only a single premium purchase of life insurance could be a transfer versus a multi-premium?
No, I think it's a broader consideration. And so essentially what the department's position is looking at the language of this regulation, you have to see that the prohibited conduct is conducting an action that prevents you from receiving your income or resources. And based on that, you look to the list for guidance, for as an example of transfers, prohibited transfers, and the characteristics associated with those transfers, so that you can then make an informed decision on the types of financial instruments before you. There are thousands of variations of all financial instruments. I mean, how many different kinds of trusts, annuities, life insurance policies are there? It's not possible for the department to list them all, and it would be absurd to do so.
So I'm trying to understand how you draw the line here under the regulation as it was written prior to 2012. So what would the department's position be if he bought this exact same policy and he had to make two payments, one for $80,000 right off the bat and another one a year later for $80,000?
Well, Judge, I don't want to speculate, but I feel that the same analysis would apply. You would look to the language of the regulation and look initially first to see whether your action is preventing you from receiving income or resources available to you. So let's say he split it up. Let's say he wanted to do a double premium life insurance policy of $80,000 each. You're still transferring a large sum of money that would have been available to you a month before you applied for Medicaid benefits. So you're within the look-back period. You're transferring this large sum of money, and you look to this list of financial instruments that was, you know, back in 2006, and you can say, okay, well, we have annuities here, we have trust, we have all these kinds of financial instruments whereby you no longer have any control over your assets. You've relinquished all control, and it will pay out to somebody else. I will never see that money again. It is a transfer. That is the kind of scenario that I think directly applies here, and that would have been clear to any reasonable person reading the statute, that you can't simply transfer $161,000 that you had for your own well-being and maintenance into an instrument that you technically, in a legal sense, own, but in no way will ever have any control or ownership in any meaningful sense over that fund, over those funds again.
What if, and I know hypotheticals are the bane of oral argument, but what if he bought a policy for 12 payments over a year that added up to $160,000?
I think, you know, you start to get into a more gray area, perhaps. I won't speculate what the department's position is in that instance. I think that, you know, in an instance that we have here where it was $161,000 in a one-time payment, it was a very clear transfer. He would never see that money again. There was no question that this was a transfer without fair consideration.
But if there is a gray area somewhere and nobody knows where it is, why is an opposing counsel's argument have some persuasiveness? How in the world were the Irelands and their lawyers supposed to know where that line was?
Well, on the flip side to that, how in the world would the department be able to list all of the variations that can possibly arise in the world of financial instruments and the various ways that you can shelter your money? I mean, there's just so many different ways that you can structure this in an attempt to avoid a Medicaid penalty. But, you know, at the end of the day, let's remember what Medicaid is for. These are for indigent individuals who cannot provide for their own care. You have a gentleman who has $161,000, which he's admitted he just wanted to be able to leave to his children. Fair enough. No one's saying you can't do that, but you will incur a penalty. And
counsel, I have a question. Is there a procedure, this is not in the briefs, and so you may not know the answer in any event, is there a procedure by which a potential applicant for Medicaid can submit a question to the department and inquiring, what if I was to do this, would you consider this a transfer and rely on some advice from the department or from the counties?
I believe there is. I can't speak specifically to where or how, but I know that I think there's a hotline or some sort of community position that you can reach out to the department prior to doing something like this, where the department could take a position one way or the other.
Before I forget to ask you, I was a little bit confused about the final part of your brief, considering whether there was fair consideration received. I took your first point to be that Mr. Ireland received no consideration whatsoever from the purchase of this policy. But then you went on to say, additionally, the beneficiaries are not receiving the full amount of consideration given the purchase price. Is that an alternative argument? Are those somehow consistent points? I wasn't sure what you were doing with that.
Yes, I apologize if I was unclear. Essentially, the department's position is that he is receiving no consideration at all because he would not receive the benefit of any of this. But even if the court were to consider the idea that his children receiving his funds was somehow consideration to him, then the more technical, you know, did he even receive the value of the policy on its face, argument is that he didn't even get the $161,000 in return, and so under the definition of valuable consideration, he would not have qualified even under that. So the department, to be clear, the department's position is that he himself did not receive any valuable consideration, Mr. Ireland. However, if for whatever reason the court felt that, which I argue vehemently against, if the court felt that there was some consideration in the value of him being able to transfer that to his children, then I would argue that the policy on its face does not give him a return that would allow for a valuable consideration to be.
Thank you.
I would like to just wrap up quickly by emphasizing the underlying policy issues underlying this regulation. Again, we are talking about a government benefits program here. This is a social safety net. Medicaid is a program that exists for the purpose of providing medical care to indigent and disabled individuals. In keeping with this, Medicaid always has to be the payer of last resort, always. This has been mandated by the General Assembly. This is a fundamental principle to the program and the success of the program. In other words, all other available resources have to be utilized prior to an individual looking to Medicaid for assistance. It was never intended that an individual should be able to transfer their wealth to their children so that the taxpayers could then shoulder the burden of their medical care. So with that, I would just like to conclude that if there are no further questions, the department requests that this court affirm the district court's order of April 26, 2011, affirming the department's final agency decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you got 37 seconds.
Okay. Thank you. I'll try to make a few points that I think are important. One is all purchases of life insurance make money unavailable to the person who purchases it if they're irrevocable, which they have to be in this context. That by itself cannot invoke a transfer. A defendant has never argued that that creates a penalty period by itself. You do have to look to the context, the examples given in the regulations, and this is very unlike those examples. Second, to go to a question that you were asking, the Irons attorneys didn't simply appeal. They made a whole years of requests for clarification, for meetings, all of which went unanswered in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Division will issue an opinion in due course.